We didn't see anything terribly exotic or even remotely exotic. But it was nice just to see squirrels and deer, to feel that the forest was lived in. Late in the afternoon, I rounded a bend to find a wild turkey and her chicks crossing the trail ahead of me. The mother was regal and unflappable. Her chicks were much too busy falling over and getting up again even to notice me. This was the way the woods were supposed to be. I couldn't have been more delighted. We hiked till 5 and camped beside a tranquil spring in a small grassy clearing in the trees just off the trail. Because it was our first day back on the trail, we were flush for food, including perishables like cheese and bread that had to be eaten before they went off or were shaken to bits in our packs. So we rather gorged ourselves, then sat around smoking and chatting idly until persistent and numerous midge-like creatures, no-see-ums, as they are universally known along the trail, drove us into our tents. It was perfect sleeping weather, cool enough to need a bag, but warm enough that you could sleep in your underwear. And I was looking forward to a long night's snooze, indeed was enjoying a long night's snooze, when, at some indeterminate dark hour, there was a sound nearby that made my eyes fly open. Normally, I slept through everything, through thunderstorms, through cats' snoring and noisy midnight pees, so something big enough or distinctive enough to wake me was unusual. There was a sound of undergrowth being disturbed, a click of breaking branches, a weighty pushing through low foliage, and then a kind of large, vaguely irritable snuffling noise. Bear. I sat bolt upright. Instantly, every neuron in my brain was awake and dashing around frantically, like ants when you disturb their nests. I reached instinctively for my knife, then realized I had left it in my pack just outside the tent. Nocturnal defense had ceased to be a concern after many successive nights of tranquil woodland repose. There was another noise quite near.
"Stephen, you awake?" I whispered.
"Yup,"
he replied in a weary but normal voice.
"What was that?"
"How the hell should I know?"
"It sounded big."
"Everything sounds big in the woods."
This was true. Once a skunk had come plodding through our camp, and it had sounded like a stegosaurus. There was another heavy rustle, and then the sound of lapping at the spring. It was having a drink, whatever it was. I shuffled on my knees to the foot of the tent, cautiously unzipped the mesh and peered out, but it was pitch black. As quietly as I could, I brought in my backpack, and with the light of a small flashlight searched through it for my knife. When I found it and opened the blade, I was appalled at how wimpy it looked. It was a perfectly respectable appliance for, say, buttering pancakes, but patently inadequate for defending oneself against 400 pounds of ravenous fur. Carefully, very carefully, I climbed from the tent and put on the flashlight, which cast a distressingly feeble beam. Something about 15 or 20 feet away looked up at me. I couldn't see anything at all of its shape or size, only two shining eyes. It went silent, whatever it was, and stared back at me.
"Stephen," I whispered at his tent, "did you pack a knife?"
"No."
"Have you got anything sharp at all?"
He thought for a moment.
"Nail clippers."
I made a despairing face.
"Anything a little more vicious than that? Because, you see, there is definitely something out here."
"It's probably just a skunk."
"Then it's one big skunk. Its eyes are 3 feet off the ground."
"A deer, then."
I nervously threw a stick at the animal, and it didn't move, whatever it was. A deer would have bolted. This thing just blinked once and kept staring. I reported this to Katz.
"Probably a buck. They're not so timid. Try shouting at it."
I cautiously shouted at it.
"Hey! You there! Scat!"
The creature blinked again, singularly unmoved.
"You shout,"
I said.
"Oh, you brute, go away, do,"
Katz shouted in merciless imitation.
"Please withdraw at once, you horrid creature."
"Fuck you," I said, and lugged my tent right over to his. I didn't know what this would achieve exactly, but it brought me a tiny measure of comfort to be nearer to him.
"What are you doing?" I'm moving my tent.
Oh, good plan. That'll really confuse it.
I peered and peered, but I couldn't see anything but those two wide-set eyes staring from the near distance, like eyes in a cartoon. I couldn't decide whether I wanted to be outside and dead or inside and waiting to be dead. I was barefoot and in my underwear and shivering. What I really wanted, really, really wanted, was for the animal to withdraw. I picked up a small stone and tossed it at it. I think it may have hit it because the animal made a sudden noisy start, which scared the bejesus out of me and brought a whimper to my lips, and then emitted a noise, not quite a growl, but near enough. It occurred to me that perhaps I oughtn't provoke it.
What are you doing, Bryson? Just leave it alone and it'll go away.
How can you be so calm?
What do you want me to do? You're hysterical enough for both of us.
I think I have a right to be a trifle alarmed, pardon me. I'm in the woods, in the middle of nowhere, in the dark, staring at a bear with a guy who has nothing to defend himself with but a pair of nail clippers. Let me ask you this. If it is a bear, and it comes for you, what are you going to do? Give it a pedicure?
I'll cross that bridge when I come to it, Cat said implacably.
What do you mean you cross that bridge? We're on the bridge, you moron. There's a bear out here, for Christ's sake. He's looking at us. He smells noodles and Snickers and... Oh, shit!
What?
Oh, shit!
What?
There's two of them. I can see another pair of eyes.
Just then, the flashlight battery started to go. The light flickered and then vanished. I scampered into my tent, stabbing myself lightly but hysterically in the thigh as I went, and began a quietly frantic search for spare batteries. If I were a bear, this would be the moment I would choose to lunge.
Well, I'm going to sleep, Katz announced.
What are you talking about? You can't go to sleep.
Sure I can. I've done it lots of times.
There was the sound of him rolling over and a series of snuffling noises, not unlike those of the creature outside.
Stephen, you can't go to sleep, I ordered.
But he could, and he did, with amazing rapidity. The creatures now, resumed drinking, with heavy, lapping noises. I couldn't find any replacement batteries, so I flung the flashlight aside and put my miner's lamp on my head, made sure it worked, then switched it off to conserve the batteries. Then I sat for ages on my knees, facing the front of the tent, listening keenly, gripping my walking stick like a club, ready to beat back an attack, with my knife open and at hand as a last line of defense. The bears, animals, whatever they were, drank for perhaps 20 minutes more, then quietly departed the way they had come. It was a joyous moment, but I knew from my reading that they would be likely to return. I listened and listened, but the forest returned to silence and stayed there. Eventually I loosened my grip on the walking stick and put on a sweater, pausing twice to examine the tiniest noises, dreading the sound of a revisit, and after a very long time got back into my sleeping bag for warmth. I lay there for a long time staring at total blackness, and knew that never again would I sleep in the woods with a light heart. And then, irresistibly and by degrees, I fell asleep.
Chapter 12. I'd expected Katz to be insufferable in the morning, but in fact he was surprisingly gracious. He called me for coffee, and when I emerged, feeling wretched and cheated of sleep, he said to me,
"You okay? You look like shit."
"Didn't get enough sleep," he nodded.
"So, you think it really was a bear?"
"Who knows?" I suddenly thought of the food bag. That's what bears normally go for. And spun my head to see, but it was safely suspended a dozen or so feet from the ground from a branch about 20 yards away. Probably a determined bear could have gotten it down. Actually, my grandmother could have gotten it down.
"Maybe not," I said, disappointed.
"Well, you know what I've got in here, just in case?"
Cat said, and tapped his shirt pocket significantly.
"Toenail clippers. Because you just never know when danger might arise. I've learned my lesson, believe me, buddy."
Then he guffawed. And so we returned to the woods. For virtually the length of Shenandoah National Park, the AT closely parallels and often crosses Skyline Drive, though most of the time you would scarcely guess it. Often you will be plodding through the sanctuary of woods when suddenly a car will sail past, through the trees only 40 or 50 feet away, a perennially startling sight. In the early 1930s, the Potomac Appalachian Trail Club, which was Myron Avery's baby, and for a time virtually indistinguishable from the Appalachian Trail Conference itself, came under attack from other hiking groups, particularly the patrician Appalachian Mountain Club in Boston, for not resisting the building of Skyline Drive through the park. Stung by these rebukes, Avery sent McKay a deeply insulting letter in December 1935, which effectively terminated McKay's official, but even then peripheral, relationship with the trail. The two men never spoke again, though to his credit McKay paid Avery a warm tribute on his death in 1952, and generously noted that the trail could not have been built without him. A lot of people still dislike the highway, but Katz and I quite warmed to it. Frequently we would leave the trail and hike on the road for an hour or two. This early in the season, it was still early April, there were hardly any cars in the park, so we treated Skyline Drive as a kind of broad, paved, alternative footpath. It was novel to have something firm underfoot, and exceedingly agreeable to be out in the open, in warm sunshine, after weeks in impenetrable woods. Motorists certainly had a more cosseted, looked-after existence than we did. There were frequent expansive overlooks with splendid views, though even now, in clear spring weather, blanketed with a dirty haze beyond about 6 or 7 miles. Information boards giving helpful explanatory notes on the park's wildlife and flora, and even litter bins. We could do with some of this on the trail, we agreed. And then, when the sun got too hot, or our feet grew sore, for pavement is surprisingly hard on the feet, or we just felt like a change, we would return to the familiar, cool, embracing woods. It was very agreeable. Almost rakish to have options. At one of the Skyline Drive turn-ins that we came to, an information board was angled to direct the reader's attention to a nearby slope, handsomely spread with hemlocks, a very dark, almost black native conifer, particularly characteristic of the Blue Ridge. All these hemlocks, and all the hemlocks everywhere along the trail and far beyond, are being killed by an aphid introduced accidentally from Asia in 1924. The National Park Service, the board noted sadly, could not afford to treat the trees. There were too many of them over too wide an area to make a spraying program practicable. Well, here's an idea. Why not treat some of the trees? Why not treat a tree? The good news, according to the board, was that the National Park Service hoped that some of the trees would stage a natural recovery over time. Well, whew, for that. 60 years ago, there were almost no trees on the Blue Ridge Mountains. All this was farmland. Often in the woods now, the trail would follow the relics of old stone field walls, and once we passed a small, remote cemetery, reminders that this was one of the few mountaintop areas in the entire Appalachian chain where people once actually lived. Unluckily for them, they were the wrong kind of people. In the 1920s, sociologists and other academics from the cities ventured into the hills, and they were invariably appalled at what they found. Poverty and deprivation were universal. The land was ridiculously poor. Many people were farming slopes that were practically perpendicular. 3/4 of the people in the hills couldn't read. Most had barely gone to school. Illegitimacy was 90%. Sanitation was practically unknown. Only 10% of households had even a basic privy. On top of that, the Blue Ridge Mountains were sensationally beautiful and conveniently sited for the benefit of a new class of motoring tourist. The obvious solution was to move the people off the mountaintops and into the valleys, where they could be poor lower down, build a scenic highway for people to cruise up and down on Sundays, and turn the whole thing into a great mountaintop fun zone, with commercial campgrounds, restaurants, ice cream parlors, miniature golf, and whatever else might turn a snappy dollar. Unfortunately for the entrepreneurs, then came the Great Depression, and the commercial impulse withered. Instead, under that dizzying socialist impulse that marked the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, the land was bought for the nation. The people were moved out, and the Civilian Conservation Corps was put to work building pretty stone bridges, picnic shelters, visitor centers, and much else, and the whole was opened to the public in July 1936. It is the quality of craftsmanship that accounts substantially for the glory of Shenandoah National Park. Indeed, it is one of the few examples of large-scale human handiwork. Hoover Dam is another, and Mount Rushmore, I would submit, as a third, anywhere in the United States that complements, even enhances, a natural landscape. I suppose that, too, is one reason I liked walking along Skyline Drive, with its broad, lawn-like grass verges and stone-retaining walls, its clusters of artfully planted birches, its gentle curves leading to arresting, thoughtfully composed panoramas. This is the way all highways should be. For a time, it looked as if all highways would be like this. It is no accident that the first highways in America were called parkways. That's what they were envisioned to be, parks you could drive through. Almost none of this spirit of craftsmanship is evident on the AT in the park. You wouldn't expect it to on a trail devoted to wilderness. But it is agreeably encountered in the park's shelters, or huts, which have something of a picturesque rusticity of the smoky shelters, but are airier, cleaner, better designed, and without those horrible, depressing chain-link fences across their fronts. Though Katz thought I was preposterous, I insisted on sleeping at shelters after our night at the spring, I somehow felt I could defend a shelter against marauding bears, and, in any case, the Shenandoah shelters were too nice not to use. Every one of them was attractive, thoughtfully sited, and had a good water source, picnic table, and privy. For two nights we had shelters to ourselves, and on the third we were just exchanging congratulations on this remarkable string of luck when we heard a cacophony of voices approaching through the woods. We peeked around the corner and found a Boy Scout troop marching into the clearing. They said hello, and we said hello. And then we sat with our legs dangling from the sleeping platform and watched them fill the clearing with their tents and abundant gear, pleased to have something to look at other than each other. There were 3 adult supervisors and 17 Boy Scouts, all charmingly incompetent. Tents went up, then swiftly collapsed or keeled over. One of the adults went off to filter water and fell in the creek. Even Katz agreed that this was better than TV. For the first time since we had left New Hampshire, we felt like masters of the trail. A few minutes later, a cheerful lone hiker arrived. His name was John Connolly, and he was a high school teacher from upstate New York. He had been hiking the trail, evidently only a couple of miles behind us, for 4 days, and had been camping alone in the open each night, which struck me now as awfully brave. He hadn't seen any bears. Indeed, he had been section hiking the trail for years and had seen a bear only once, briefly, rump end and fleeing, deep in the Maine woods. John was followed shortly by 2 men about our age from Louisville, Jim and Chuck, both real nice fellows, self-effacing and funny. We hadn't seen more than 3 or 4 hikers since leaving Waynesboro, and now suddenly we were mobbed. "What day is it?" I asked, and everyone had to stop and think. "Friday," someone said. Yeah, Friday." That explained it, the start of a weekend. We all sat around the picnic table, cooking and eating. It was wonderfully convivial. The 3 others had hiked a great deal and told us all about the trail ahead of us as far as Maine, which still seemed as distant as the next cosmos. Then the conversation turned to a perennial favorite among hikers, how crowded the trail had become. Connolly talked about how he had hiked nearly half the trail in 1987, at the height of summer, and had gone days without seeing anyone, and Jim and Chuck heartily seconded this. This is something you hear a lot, and it is certainly true that more people are hiking than ever before. Until the 1970s, fewer than 50 people a year thru-hiked the AT. As recently as 1984, the number was just 100. By 1990, it had pushed past 200, and today it is approaching 300. These are big increases. but they are also still tiny, tiny numbers. Just before we set off, my local newspaper in New Hampshire had an interview with a trail maintainer who noted that 20 years ago, the three campsites in his section averaged about a dozen visitors a week in July and August, and that now they sometimes get as many as 100 in a week. The amazing thing about that, if you ask me, is that they got so few for so long. Anyway, 100 visitors a week for three campsites at the height of summer hardly seems overwhelming. Perhaps I was coming at this from the wrong direction, having hiked in crowded little England for so long. But what never ceased to astonish me throughout our long summer was how empty the trail was. Nobody knows how many people hike the Appalachian Trail, but most estimates put the number at around 3 or 4 million a year. If 4 million is right, and we assume that probably 3/4 of that hiking is done during the 6 warmest months, that means an average of 16,500 people on the trail a day in season, or 7.5 people for each mile of trail, one person every 700 feet. In fact, few sections will experience anything like that high a density. A very high proportion of those 4 million annual hikers will be concentrated in certain popular places for a day or a weekend. The Presidential Range in New Hampshire, Baxter State Park in Maine, Mount Greylock in Massachusetts, in the Smokies, and Shenandoah National Park. That 4 million will also include a high proportion of what you might call Reebok hikers, people who park their car, walk 400 yards, get back in their car, drive off, and never do anything as breathtaking as that again. Believe me, no matter what anyone tells you, the Appalachian Trail is not crowded. When people bleat on about the trail being too crowded, what they mean is that the shelters are too crowded, and this is indubitably sometimes so. The problem, however, is not that there are too many hikers for the shelters, but too few shelters for the hikers. Shenandoah National Park has just 8 huts, each able to accommodate no more than 8 people in comfort, 10 at a pinch, in 101 miles of national park. That's about average for the trail overall. Although the distances between shelters can vary enormously, there is on average an AT shelter, cabin, hut, or lean-to, 240 of them altogether, about every 10 miles. That means adequate covered sleeping space for just 2,500 hikers over 2,200 miles of trail. When you consider that more than 100 million Americans live within a day's drive of the Appalachian Trail, it is hardly surprising that 2,500 sleeping spaces is sometimes not enough. Yet, perversely, pressure is growing in some quarters to reduce the number of shelters, to discourage what is seen, amazingly to me, as overuse of the trail. So, as always, when the conversation turned to the crowdedness of the trail, and the fact that you now sometimes see a dozen people in a day, when formerly you would have been lucky to see 2, I listened politely and said, "You guys ought to try hiking in England." Jim turned to me and said, in a kindly, patient way, "But you see, Bill, we're not in England." Perhaps he had a point. Now here is another reason I am exceptionally fond of Shenandoah National Park, and why I am probably not cut out to be a proper American trail hiker. Cheeseburgers. You can get cheeseburgers quite regularly in Shenandoah National Park, and Coca-Cola with ice, and French fries, and ice cream, and a good deal else. Although the rampant commercialization I spoke of a moment ago never happened, and thank goodness, of course, something of that esprit de commerce lives on in Shenandoah. The park is liberally sprinkled with public campgrounds and rest stops with restaurants and shops. And the AT, God bless it, pays nearly every one of them a call. It is entirely against the spirit of the AT to have restaurant breaks along the trail, but I never met a hiker who didn't appreciate it to bits. Katz, Connolly, and I had our first experience of it the next morning, after we had said farewell to Jim and Chuck and the Boy Scouts, who were all headed south. When we arrived about lunchtime at a lively commercial sprawl called Big Meadows. Big Meadows had a campground, a lodge, a restaurant, a gift shop, general store, and lots of people spread around a big, sunny, grassy space. Although it is a big meadow, it was actually named for a guy named Meadows, which pleased me very much for some reason. We dropped our packs on the grass outside and hastened into the busy restaurant, where we greedily partook of everything greasy, then repaired to the lawn to smoke and burp and enjoy a spell of tranquil digestion. As we lay there, propped against our packs, a tourist in an unfortunate straw hat, clutching an ice cream, came up and looked us over in a friendly manner.
"So, you fellas hiking?" he said.
We said we were.
"And you carry those packs?"
"Until we find someone to carry them for us,"
said Katz cheerfully.
"How far you come this morning?"
"Oh, about 8 miles."
8 miles, Lord! And how far you go this afternoon?"
"Oh, maybe another 8 miles."
"No kidding, 16 miles on foot? With those things on your back? Man, ain't that a kick?"
He called across the lawn.
"Bernice, come here a minute. You gotta see this."
He looked at us again.
"So what do you got in there? Clothes and stuff, I suppose?"
"And food," said Connolly.
"You carry your own food, huh?"
"Have to."
"Well, ain't that a kick?"
Bernice arrived, and he explained to her that we were using our legs to proceed across the landscape.
"Ain't that something? They got all their food and everything in those packs."
"Is that a fact?"
Bernice said with admiration and interest.
"So you're, like, walking everywhere?"
We nodded.
"You walked here, all the way up here?"
"We walk everywhere," said Katz solemnly.
"You never walked all the way up here."
"Well, we did," said Katz,
for whom this was becoming one of the proudest moments of his life. I went off to call home from a payphone and use the men's room. When I returned a few minutes later, Katz had accumulated a small, appreciative crowd and was demonstrating the use and theory of various straps and toggles on his backpack. Then, at someone's behest, he put the pack on and posed for pictures. I had never seen him so happy. While he was still occupied, Connolly and I went into the little grocery part of the complex to have a look around, and I realized just how little regarded and incidental hikers are to the real business of the park. Only 3% of Shenandoah's 2 million annual visitors go more than a few yards into what is generously termed the backcountry. 90% of visitors arrive in cars or motorhomes. This was a store for them. Nearly everything in the store required microwaving, or oven heating, or scrupulous refrigeration, or came in large, family-sized quantities. It's a rare hiker who wants 24 hamburger buns, I find. There was not a single item of conventional trail food, raisins or peanuts or small portable quantities of packets or canned goods, which was a little dispiriting in a national park. With no choice, and desperate not to eat noodles again if we could possibly help it, Connolly, I was delighted to learn, was also a noodles man, we bought 24 hot dogs and matching buns, a 2-liter bottle of Coke, and a couple of large bags of cookies. Then we collected Katz, who announced regretfully to his adoring audience that he had to go, there were mountains still to climb, and stepped valiantly back into the woods. We stopped for the night at a lovely, secluded spot called Rock Spring Hut, perched on a steep hillside with a long view over the Shenandoah Valley far below. The shelter even had a swing, a 2-seater that hung on chains from the shelter overhang, put there in memory of one Teresa Affronti, who had loved the trail, according to a plaque on its back, which I thought was rather splendid. Earlier visitors to the shelter had left behind an assortment of canned foods, beans, corn, spam, baby carrots, which were lined up carefully along one of the support rafters. You find this sort of thing quite a lot on the trail. In some places, friends of the trail will hike up to shelters with homemade cookies or platters of fried chicken. It's quite wonderful. While we were cooking dinner, a young southbound thru-hiker, the first of the season, arrived. He had hiked 26 miles that day and thought he had died and gone to heaven when he learned that hot dogs were on the menu. 6 hot dogs apiece was more than Katz and Connolly and I could eat, so we each ate 4 and a quantity of cookies and saved the rest for breakfast. But the young southbounder ate as if he had never eaten before, He downed 6 hot dogs, then a can of baby carrots, and gratefully accepted a dozen or so Oreos, one after the other, and ate them with great savor and particularity. He told us he had started in Maine, in deep snow, and had been endlessly caught in blizzards, but was still averaging 25 miles a day. He was only about 5'6", and his pack was enormous. No wonder he had an appetite. He was trying to hike the trail in 3 months, mostly by putting in very long days. When we woke in the morning, dawn was only just leaking in, but he had already gone. Where he had slept, there was a brief note thanking us for the food and wishing us luck. We never did learn his name. Late the next morning, when I realized that I had considerably outstripped Katz and Connolly, who were talking and not making particularly good time, I stopped to wait for them in a broad, ancient-seeming, deeply fetching glade cradled by steep hills, which gave it a vaguely enchanted, secretive feel. Everything you could ask for in a woodland setting was here. Tall, stately trees broken at intervals by escalators of dusty sunshine, winding brook, floor of plump ferns, cool air languidly adrift in a lovely green stillness. And I remember thinking what an exceptionally nice place this would be to camp. Just over a month later, 2 young women, Lolly Winans and Julianne Williams, evidently had the same thought. They pitched their tents somewhere in this tranquil grove, then hiked the short way through the woods to Skyland Lodge, another commercial complex, to eat in its restaurant. No one knows exactly what happened, but some person at Skyland presumably watched them dine, then followed them back to their campsite. They were found 3 days later in their tents with their hands bound and their throats cut. There was no apparent motive. There has never been a suspect. Their deaths will almost certainly forever be a mystery. Of course, I had no idea of this at the time. So when Katz and Connolly caught up, I simply observed to them what an attractive spot it was. They looked at it and agreed, and then we moved on. We had lunch with Connolly at Skyland, and then he left us to hitchhike back to his car at Rockfish Gap and return home. Katz and I bade him farewell and then pushed on, for that was what we did. We had nearly completed the first part of our adventure, so there was a certain homestretch perkiness in our steps. We walked for 3 days more, stopping at restaurants when we came to them, and camping in shelters, which once again we had mostly to ourselves. On our next to last day on the trail, our 6th since setting off from Rockfish Gap, we were walking along beneath dull skies when there came an abrupt cold roaring of wind. Trees danced and swayed, dust and leaves rose up around us in boisterous swirls, and our jackets and outerwear took on sudden lives of their own, leaping and flapping about us. There was a roll of thunder, and then it began to rain. A really cold, miserable, penetrating rain. We sheathed ourselves in nylon and stoically pushed on. It turned out to be an awful day in nearly every way. In the early afternoon, I discovered that I had lost my backpack rain cover, which, may I just say here, was a completely useless, ill-designed piece of crap anyway, for which I paid $25, and that nearly everything in my pack now ranged from disagreeably damp to completely sodden. I had, fortunately, taken to wrapping my sleeping bag in a double thickness of trash bags, cost 35 cents. So it at least was dry. 20 minutes later, as I sheltered under a bough, waiting for Katz, he arrived and immediately said, "Hey, where's your stick?" I had lost my beloved walking stick. I suddenly remembered propping it against a tree when I had stopped to tie a lace, and was filled with despair. That stick had seen me through 6.5 weeks of mountains, had become all but part of me. It was a link with my children, whom I missed more than I can tell you. I felt like weeping. I told Katz where I thought I'd left it, at a place called Elk Wallow Gap, about 4 miles back. "I'll get it for you," he said without hesitation and started to drop his pack. I could have wept again. He really meant it. But I wouldn't let him go. It was too far. And besides, Elk Wallow Gap was a public place. Someone would have taken it as a souvenir by now. So we pressed on to a spot called Gravel Springs Hut. It was only 2:30 when we got there. We had planned to go at least 6 miles farther, But we were so soaked, and the rain was so unrelenting, that we decided to stop. I had no dry clothes, so I stripped to my boxer shorts and climbed into my sleeping bag. We spent the longest afternoon I can ever remember listlessly reading and staring out at the pattering rain. At about 5 o'clock, just to make our day complete, a group of 6 noisy people arrived, 3 men and 3 women, dressed in the most preposterously Ralph Lauren-style hiking clothes, safari jackets and broad-brimmed canvas hats and suede hiking boots. These were clothes for sauntering along the veranda at Mackinac, or perhaps going on a jeep safari, but patently not for hiking. One of the women, arriving a few paces behind the others and walking through the mud as if it were radioactive, peered into the shelter at me and Katz, and said with undisguised distaste, "Ooh, do we have to share?" They were, to a degree that would have been fascinating in less trying circumstances, stupid, obnoxious, cheerfully but astonishingly self-absorbed, and not remotely acquainted with trail etiquette. Katz and I found ourselves carelessly bumped and jostled into the darkest corners, sprayed with water from clothes being shaken out, and knocked in the head with casually discarded equipment. In astonishment, we watched as clothes we had hung up to dry on a small clothesline were pushed and bunched to one side to make abundant room for their stuff. I sat sullenly, unable to concentrate on my book, while 2 of the men crouched beside me, in my light, and had the following conversation. "I've never done this before." "What, camp in a shelter?" "No, look through binoculars with my glasses on." "Oh, I thought you meant camp in a shelter. Ha ha ha." "No, I meant look through binoculars with my glasses on. After about a half an hour of this, Katz came over, knelt beside me, and said in a whisper, "One of these guys just called me sport. I'm getting the fuck out of here." "What are you going to do?" "Pitch my tent in the clearing. You coming?" "I'm in my underpants," I said pathetically. Katz nodded in understanding and stood up.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he announced, "can I have your attention for a minute? Excuse me, sport, can I have your attention? We're going to go out and pitch our tents in the rain, so you can have all the space in here. But my friend here is in his boxer shorts and is afraid of offending the ladies, and maybe exciting the gentlemen." He added with a brief, sweet leer, "So, could you turn your heads for a minute while he puts his wet clothes back on? Meanwhile, I'll say goodbye and thank you for allowing us to share a few inches of your space for a little while. It's been a slice."
Then he jumped down into the rain. I dressed hastily, surrounded by silence and self-consciously averted gazes, then bounded down with a small, wimply neutral goodbye. We pitched our tents about 30 yards away, not an easy or enjoyable process in a driving rain, believe me, and climbed in. Before we had finished, voices from the shelter had resumed and were succeeded by peals of triumphant laughter. They were noisy until dark, then drunkenly noisy until the small hours. I wondered if at any point they would experience some twinge of charity or remorse and send over a peace offering, a brownie perhaps, or a hot dog. But they did not. When we woke in the morning, the rain had stopped, though the world was still insipid and dreary, and water was dripping from the trees. We didn't bother with coffee. We just wanted to get out of there. We broke down our tents and packed away our stuff. Katz went to get a shirt from the line and reported that our 6 friends were sleeping heavily. There were 2 empty bourbon bottles, he reported in a tone of disdain. We hefted our packs and set off down the trail. We had walked perhaps 400 yards out of sight of the camp when Katz stopped me.
"You know that woman who said, 'Ooh, do we have to share?' and shoved our clothes to the end of the clothesline?" he asked.
I nodded. Of course I remembered her.
"Well, I'm not real proud of this. I want you to understand that. But when I went to get my shirt, I noticed her boots were right by the edge of the platform and, well, I did something kind of bad."
"What?"
I tried to imagine, but couldn't.
He opened his hand, and there were 2 suede shoelaces. Then he beamed, a big winning beam, and stuck them in his pocket, and walked on. Part 2 Chapter 13 And that was about it for the start of our great adventure. We walked 18 miles to Front Royal, where my wife was to pick us up in 2 days if she managed to find her way by car from New Hampshire in an unfamiliar country. I had to go off for a month to do other things, principally try to persuade people to buy a book of mine, even though it had nothing to do with effortless weight loss, running with the wolves, thriving in an age of anxiety, or the O.J. Simpson trial. Even so, it sold over 60 copies. Katz was going back to Des Moines, where he had a job offer for the summer building houses, though he promised to come back in August and hike the famous and forbidding 100-mile wilderness in Maine with me. At one point, very early in the trip, he had talked earnestly of doing the whole trail, pushing on alone until I was able to rejoin him in June. But when I mentioned this now, he just gave a hollow laugh and invited me to join him in the real world when I felt up to it.
"To tell you the truth, I'm amazed we've come this far," he said, and I agreed.
We had hiked 500 miles, 1.25 million steps, since setting off from Amicalola. We had grounds to be proud. We were real hikers now. We had shit in the woods and slept with bears. We had become, we would forever be, mountain men. 18 miles was a heroic distance for us, but we were filthy and trail-weary and more than ready for a town, and so we plodded on. We reached Front Royal about 7, dead tired, and went to the first motel we came to. It was arrestingly dire, but cheap. The bed sagged. The TV picture jumped as if it were being mercilessly goosed by an electronic component, and my door didn't lock. It pretended to lock, but if you pushed on it from outside with a finger, it popped open. This perplexed me for a moment, until I realized that no one could possibly want any of my possessions, so I just pulled it shut and went off to find Katz and go to dinner. We ate at a steakhouse down the street and retired happily to our televisions and beds. In the morning, I went early to Kmart and bought 2 complete new sets of clothes, socks, underwear, blue jeans, sneakers, handkerchiefs, and the 2 liveliest shirts I could find, one with boats and anchors, the other with a famous Monuments of Europe motif. I returned to the motel, presented Katz with 1/2. He couldn't have been more thrilled. Then went to my room and put on my new attire. We met in the motel parking lot 10 minutes later, looking crisp and stylish, and exchanged many flattering comments. With a day to kill, we went for breakfast, had an idle, contented saunter through the modest central business district, poked around in thrift shops for something to do, found a camping store where I bought a replacement hiking stick exactly like the one I had lost, had lunch, and in the afternoon decided naturally to go for a walk. It was, after all, what we did. We found some railroad tracks which followed the stately curves of the Shenandoah River. There is nothing more agreeable, more pleasantly summery, than to stroll along railroad tracks in a new shirt. We walked without haste or particular purpose, mountain men on holiday, chatting seamlessly about nothing in particular, stepping aside from time to time to let a freight train lumber past, and generally enjoying the abundant sunshine, the beckoning, infinite gleam of silver track, and the simple pleasure of moving forward on legs that felt tireless. We walked almost till sunset. It was a perfect way to finish. The following morning we went to breakfast, and then came the 3 hours of fidgety torture of standing at the edge of a motel drive, watching traffic for a particular car filled with beaming, excited, much-missed faces. For weeks and weeks I had tried not to visit that shadowy ache where thoughts of my family lay, but now that they were nearly here, now that I could let my thoughts run free, the anticipation was nearly unbearable. Well, you can imagine, I'm sure, the joyous reunion scene when they finally arrived. The exuberant hugs, the scattergun chatter, the tumble of needlessly but delightfully detailed information about the problems of finding the right interstate exit and correct motel, the impressed appraisal of Dad's new body, the less impressed appraisal of his new shirt, the sudden remembering to include Katz, bashfully grinning on the margins, in the celebrations, the tousling of hair, the whole transcendently happy business of being rejoined. We took Katz to National Airport in Washington, where he was booked on a late afternoon flight to Des Moines. At the airport, I realized we were already in different universes, he in a where-do-I-go-to-check-in sort of distraction,
I, in the distraction of knowing that my family waited, that the car was badly parked, that it was nearly rush hour in Washington. So we parted awkwardly, almost absently, with hasty wishes for a good flight and promises to meet again in August for the conclusion of our long amble. When he was gone, I felt bad, but then I turned to the car, saw my family, and didn't think about him again for weeks. It was the end of May, almost June, before I got back on the trail. I went for a walk in the woods near our home, with a day pack containing a bottle of water, 2 peanut butter sandwiches, a map, for form's sake, and nothing else. It was summer now, so the woods were a new and different place, alive with green and filled with birdsong and swarming mosquitoes and pesky blackfly. I walked 5 miles over low hills through the woods to the town of Etna, where I sat beside an old cemetery and ate my sandwiches, then packed up and walked home. I was back before lunch. It didn't feel right at all. The next day I drove to Mount Musilauk, 50 miles from my home on the southern edge of the White Mountains. Musilauk is a wonderful mountain, one of the most beautiful in New England, with an imposing leonine grandeur, but it is rather in the middle of nowhere, so it doesn't attract a great deal of attention. It belongs to Dartmouth College of Hanover, whose famous outing club has been looking after it in a commendably diligent and low-key way since the early years of this century. Dartmouth introduced downhill skiing to America in Musilauk, and the first national championships were held there in 1933. But it was too remote, and soon the sport in New England moved to other mountains nearer main highways, and Musilauk returned to a splendid obscurity. Today you would never guess that it had ever known fame. I parked in a small dirt parking lot, the only car that day, and set off into the woods. This time I had water, peanut butter sandwiches, a map, and insect repellent. Mount Musilauk is 4,802 feet high and steep. Without a full pack, I walked straight up it without stopping, a novel and gratifying experience. The view from the top was gorgeously panoramic, but it still didn't feel right without cats, without a full pack. I was home by 4 p.m. This didn't feel right at all. You don't hike the Appalachian Trail and then go home and cut the grass. I had been so absorbed for so long with setting up and executing the first part of the trip that I hadn't actually stopped to consider where I would be at this point. Where I was, in fact, was companionless, far away from where I had gotten off the trail, and impossibly adrift from a touchingly optimistic hiking schedule I had drawn up nearly a year before. This showed me to be somewhere in the region of New Jersey by about now, blithely striding off up to 30 miles a day. It was clear that I had to make some adjustments. Even overlooking the large hunk that Katz and I had left out by jumping from Gatlinburg to Roanoke, and no matter how I juggled the numbers, it was abundantly evident that I was never going to hike the whole thing in one season. At my pace, if I returned to the trail at Front Royal where we had left off and resumed hiking north, I would be lucky to reach central Vermont by winter, 500 miles shy of the trail's northern terminus at Mount Katahdin. This time, too, there was no small, endearingly innocent pulse of excitement, that keen and eager frisson that comes with venturing into the unknown with gleaming, untried equipment. This time I knew exactly what was out there. A lot of long, taxing miles, steep rocky mountains, hard shelter floors, hot days without showers, unsatisfying meals cooked on a temperamental stove. Now, moreover, there would be all the perils that come with warmer weather. Wild and lively lightning storms, surly rattlesnakes, fever-inducing ticks, bears with appetites, and, oh, one unpredictable, motiveless, possibly drifting murderer, since reports of the deaths of the 2 women killed in Shenandoah National Park were just making the news. It was more than a little discouraging. The best I could do was to do, well, the best I could do. Anyway, I had to try. Everyone in town who knew me, not a huge number, admittedly, but enough to have me forever dodging into doorways whenever I saw a familiar face approaching along Main Street, knew that I was trying to hike the AT, which patently I could not be doing if I was to be seen skulking in town. I saw that Bryson fellow today slipping into Eastman's pharmacy with a newspaper in front of his face. I thought he was supposed to be hiking the Appalachian Trail. Anyway, you're right. He is odd. It was clear I had to get back on the trail, properly back on, far from home, somewhere at least reasonably proximate to Northern Virginia, if I was to have any pretense of hiking the trail with anything approaching completeness. The problem was that it is almost impossible nearly everywhere along the AT to get on and off the trail without assistance. I could fly to Washington or Newark or Scranton or any of several other places in the region of the trail, but in each case I would still be scores of miles short of the trail itself. I couldn't ask my dear and patient wife to take 2 days to drive me back to Virginia or Pennsylvania, so I decided to drive myself. I would, I figured, park at a likely-looking spot, take a hike up into the hills, hike back to the car, drive on a way, and repeat the process. I suspected this would turn out to be fairly unsatisfying, possibly even imbecile, and I was right on both counts, but I couldn't think of a better alternative. And thus I was to be found in the first week of June, standing on the banks of the Shenandoah again, in Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, blinking at a gray sky and trying to pretend that with all my heart, this was where I wanted to be. Harper's Ferry is an interesting place for a number of reasons. First, it is quite pretty. This is because it is a national historical park, so there are no Pizza Huts, McDonald's, Burger Kings, or even residents, at least in the lower, older part of town. Instead, you get restored or recreated buildings with plaques and interpretation boards, so it doesn't have much, or indeed any, real life, but it still has a certain beguiling, polished prettiness. You can see that it would be a truly nice place to live, if only the people could be trusted to reside there without succumbing to the urge to have Pizza Huts and Taco Bells, and personally I believe they could for as much as 18 months. So instead you get a pretend town, attractively tucked between steep hills at the confluence of the Shenandoah and Potomac Rivers. It is a national historical park because, of course, it is an historic place. It was at Harper's Ferry that the abolitionist John Brown decided to liberate America's slaves and set up a new nation of his own in northwestern Virginia, which was a pretty ambitious undertaking, considering that he had an army of just 21 people. To that end, on October 16, 1859, he and his little group stole into town under cover of darkness, captured the Federal Army without resistance — it was guarded by a single night watchman — yet still managed to kill a hapless passerby, who was, ironically, a freed black slave. When news got out that a federal armory with 100,000 rifles and a great deal of ammunition was in the hands of a small band of lunatics, the president, James Buchanan, dispatched Lieutenant Colonel Robert E. Lee, at that time still a loyal Union soldier, of course, to sort things out. It took Lee and his men less than 3 minutes of fighting to overcome the hapless rebellion. Brown was captured alive, swiftly tried, and sentenced to be hanged a month hence. One of the soldiers sent to oversee the hanging was Thomas J. Jackson, soon to become famous as Stonewall Jackson, and one of the eager onlookers in the crowd was John Wilkes Booth. So the capture of the Federal Armory at Harper's Ferry served as quite a neat overture for all that followed. Meanwhile, in the wake of Brown's little adventure, all hell was breaking loose. Northern abolitionists like Ralph Waldo Emerson made Brown a martyr, and Southern loyalists got up in arms, quite literally, at the idea that this might be the start of a trend. Before you knew it, the nation was at war. Harper's Ferry remained at the center of things throughout the exuberantly bloody conflict that followed. Gettysburg was just 30 miles to the north, Manassas a similar distance to the south, and Antietam, where, it is worth noting, twice as many men died in one day as the total American losses in the War of 1812, Mexican War, and Spanish-American War combined, was just 10 miles away. Harper's Ferry itself changed hands 8 times during the war, though the record in this regard belongs to Winchester, Virginia, a few miles south, which managed to be captured and recaptured 75 times. These days, Harper's Ferry passes its time accommodating tourists and cleaning up after floods. With 2 temperamental rivers at its feet, and a natural funnel of bluffs before and behind, it is forever being inundated. There had been a bad flood in town 6 months before, and the park staff was still busy mopping out, repainting, and carrying furnishings, artifacts, and displays down from upstairs storage rooms. 3 months after my visit, they would have to take everything back up again. At one of the houses, two of the rangers came out the door and down the walk and nodded smiles at me as they passed. Both of them, I noticed, were packing sidearms. Goodness knows what the world is coming to when park rangers carry service revolvers. I had a poke around the town, but nearly every building I went to had a locked door and a notice saying, "Closed for flood repairs." Then, I went and looked at the spot where the two rivers flow together. There was an Appalachian Trail notice board there, although it had been only about 10 days since the two women were murdered in Shenandoah National Park, there was already a small poster appealing for information. It had color photographs of them both. They were clearly photos taken by the women themselves along the trail, in hiking gear, looking happy and healthy, radiant even. It was hard to look at them, knowing their doom. It occurred to me, with a small inward start, that had the two women lived, they would very probably be arriving in Harper's Ferry just about now. That, instead of standing here looking at a poster of them, I could be chatting with them. Or indeed, given a slight alteration of luck and fate, that it could be them looking at a poster of me and Katz looking trail-happy and confident. In one of the few houses open, I found a friendly, well-informed, happily unarmed ranger named David Fox, who seemed surprised and pleased to have a visitor. He bobbed up instantly from his stool when I came in, and was clearly eager to answer any questions. We got to talking about preservation, and he mentioned how hard it was for the Park Service with so little funds to do a proper job. When the park had been formed, there had been money enough to buy only about half of the Schoolhouse Ridge battlefield above town, one of the most important, if least celebrated, of Civil War battle sites. And now a developer was in the process of building houses and shops on what Fox clearly saw as hallowed ground. The developer had even started running pipes across national park land in the confident, but, as it happened, mistaken, presumption that the Park Service wouldn't have the will or money to stop him. Fox told me I should go up and look at it. I said I would. But first I had a more important pilgrimage to make. Harper's Ferry is the headquarters of the Appalachian Trail Conference, overseers of the noble footpath to which I had dedicated my summer. The ATC occupies a modest white house on a steep hill above the old part of town. I trudged up and went in. The HQ was half office, half shop, the office portion commendably busy-looking, the shop half arrayed with AT guides and keepsakes. At one end of the public area was a large-scale model of the entire trail, which, had I seen it before I started, might well have dissuaded me from attempting such an ambitious undertaking. It was perhaps 15 feet long, and conveyed arrestingly, and at a glance, what 2,200 miles of mountains look like. Hard. The rest of the public area was filled with AT goods. T-shirts, postcards, bandanas, books, miscellaneous publications. I chose a couple of books and some postcards, and was served at the counter by a friendly young woman named Laurie Potiger, whose badge described her as an information specialist, and they seemed to have chosen the right person, for she was a mine of information. She told me that the previous year 1,500 prospective thru-hikers had started the trail, 1,200 had made it to Neal's Gap, that's a dropout rate of 20% in the first week, about a third had made it to Harper's Ferry, roughly halfway, and about 300 had reached Katahdin, a higher success rate than usual. 60 or so people had successfully hiked the trail from north to south. This year's crop of thru-hikers had been passing through for the past month. It was too early to say what the final figure for the year would be, but it would certainly be higher. It rose, in any case, almost every year. I asked her about the dangers of the trail, and she told me that in the 8 years that she had worked for the ATC, there had been just 2 confirmed cases of snakebite, neither fatal, and 1 person killed by lightning. I asked her about the recent murders. She gave a sympathetic grimace.
"It's awful. Everyone's really upset about it, because trust is such a kind of bedrock part of hiking the AT, you know. I thru-hiked myself in 1987, so I know how much you come to rely on the goodness of strangers. The trail is really all about that, isn't it? And to have that taken away, well..."
Then, remembering her position, she gave me a little bit of the official line. A brief, articulate spiel to the effect that one should never forget that the trail is not insulated from the larger ills of society, but that statistically it remains extremely safe compared with most places in America. It's had 9 murders.